Well, now we've come to the time in the program when we want to hear again from our international guests, and I'm going to ask those three to come forward. As they're coming forward, Maybelle, why don't you come over here, if you will. I will just tell you about an experience I had when I visited the work of Maybelle and Raj Aroli. They live 250 miles in from Bombay. They work in a very dusty village called Jamkhed. When they got married, they made a vow that was over and above all the promises that you and I make when we get married. In addition to all these things, they said, when we begin our work, we want to work among the village poor. It's a most amazing work. They are working now, in contrast to what the publicity said, they are working among 175 villages with 250,000 people. They are using, for the most part, illiterate village health workers. They recently received the Asian counterpart of the Nobel Prize for their work among the poor, bringing health care to many of the poor, and also breaking down the caste system. It was no wonder that when I was there, I read in the guest book of a group of medical people from England who had toured throughout the entire subcontinent of India, visiting various health facilities, to have read their words in that guest book, which are simply, "We have saved the plum until last." And it's no wonder either, in the kind of caring in the name of Jesus Christ, that it is said in a film which tells of their work, that a Hindu carpenter put a cross on the hospital just so that the people of the villages would know why the Arolis had come. I'm really pleased to present to you Maybelle Aroli.
Is it too high? Why don't you stand on there? Can you stand on there?
We don't want Maybelle to be lost this afternoon.
I think it'll be too high. I think in trying to explain what we are doing, I would like to share with you the story of a woman with whom we are working. Lalan Bai is a middle-aged woman. She comes from the untouchable class of society, and she is a widow. That means, in our society, she is the worst what a human being can be, an untouchable and a widow, which really means cursed by God, and society looks at widows as if they are the embodiment of evil because they were the cause of death of their husbands, and therefore they are not wanted anywhere in society and people shun them. When we first went to Jamkhed and started our health work, one of the basic principles that we had put down was that people should participate in the health programs and that they should make their own decisions. And so when we asked the village people to choose a village health worker, they chose this woman. They chose her because any form of service particularly related to the human body is considered demeaning, and therefore they felt that it is best to choose someone who is looked down on society. When she first came to us, first of all, she would not come and stand in front of me. She stood behind, and I asked her what her name was, and she had her head covered, and she said, "I am a Harijan, that is an untouchable woman." I asked her several times what her name was, and she wouldn't tell me, because she felt, who am I, what am I, why should I do not have a name, so to speak. I was very much disturbed at that time, and I said to our social worker, "What sort of woman have you brought? How can we possibly teach her about health, and what is she going to do in the village?" In any case, since we had said that the people should make their own decisions, I had to accept her. As the classes went on, this woman who used to sit at the back slowly started edging closer and closer to me, and after 3 or 4 weeks she started lifting her head and started asking questions. After some classes in nutrition, when she understood what the cause of a lot of the infant mortality was, she suddenly said to me, "You know, I had a son. He used to have a big pot belly, his legs were swollen up, and everyone told me that God had cursed me because I was evil. I sold my house and all my possessions, went to several temples, sacrificed goats and chickens, but nothing happened. And then I heard of a hospital. I went there. I had to stand in line. I went in. The doctor asked me how much money I had, and he took all the money I had. He gave a shot and asked me to come next day. But by next day, the child was dead. He never told me that it was due to malnutrition. I starved my child to death because I thought I was giving the wrong food. And so what I'm going to do is, I'm going to share with others what I have learned from you, and I'm going to see to it that in my village no child dies due to malnutrition." That was some time ago. It was 15 years ago that she said this. Being an untouchable woman, her life had been to clean the streets, sweep the streets, and at the end of the day, stand outside the house, being careful not to touch the walls, wait for the mayor's wife to come out, and throw a few pieces of stale bread. She would keep her sari outstretched, and they would throw a few pieces of bread and perhaps some spoiled curry, and that was her food. But as she started coming to our classes and sharing what she learned, she started going around calling women out into the streets and sharing what she had learned. And as her knowledge increased, she too started sharing. She learned about nutrition, antenatal care, maternal care, how to conduct deliveries, and later on she also learned how to handle a few medicines. She was an illiterate woman at that time. Everything was going on well in her village till suddenly someone died. A young man died. Then the people were very disturbed. They said, "What has happened? God is cursing us because we have allowed this Harijan woman to come and pollute us. And now all the young men in the village will be struck down." And so they wanted to chase her out. She came to me and she asked me, "What shall I do?" So I said, "We have a rule that we work at the pleasure of the people. And if the people do not want you, it's better you stop working." And so she returned her health kit to me. But that same night, in the high caste family, a woman went into labor and they came to call her to conduct the delivery. And she said, "No, I cannot come because I'll pollute you." Several children fell sick. And when they came, she said, "I cannot come." Then the people came to me and they asked me, "What to do? Please tell her to come back and help us." So I said, "No, that is not possible. Because today you may say that you want her, but people are going to die in your village. And every time someone dies, you'll say, she is polluting us. The best thing to do is every family in the village should sign a pledge that the problem of caste will not arise again in the village and that you will accept her unconditionally and apologize to her publicly." It took about a month, but after a month they did sign the pledge, they publicly apologized, and she was reinstated. As time went on, this woman started organizing the women. She was a very intelligent woman. She started making audiovisual aids, making up stories on how to communicate. And they started looking at the various issues which were at the root of their poverty, the social structure, the injustices to women. She organized the women and they became so bold that they went to the bank, got loans, started self-employment schemes. Then they wanted to see about the sanitation. They asked the men, and the men did not take any interest. So one night, in the middle of the night, they got up, the women, and they dug pits all over the streets, wherever the water was flowing into the streets. So when the men got up in the morning, they found that all the streets were dug up and the bullock carts couldn't go through. And then they asked what happened. So the women said, "Our children are dying because of stagnant water, bad sanitation. Now we have started the process of sanitation, you finish it." And so, of course, the men had to complete it, otherwise they wouldn't have been able to drive the bullock carts across the roads. And this way, this untouchable woman, illiterate woman, started attacking the very foundations of the society. Time for elections came to the village council. And the headman of the village, the mayor of the village, who was the real power in the village, is a landlord, moneylender, he came to me with folded hands and he said, "You know, Lalan Bhai, people are asking Lalan Bhai to stand for election against me. And if she does, I will lose and she will win." This woman, who hardly 10 years ago had to stand outside and hold out her sari for bread, was now in a position where she was shaking the very foundations of the same landlord's existence. And so I talked to Lalan Bai about it, and she said, you know, health is for all. I am for all people in the village, not just one party. And if I stand for election, then the village will be divided. And I do not want to do that. Our people are not ready for that. And so she did not stand for election. Then she said to me, in any case, I think as time goes on, I will be able to get the landlord on my side. And then we will be able to work together to make this village a better place to live in. And actually that is what happened. Hardly 3 months ago, the same landlord came to me and he said, you know, I've got an idea. Why not we make Lalan Bai stand for election and represent all of us in the county, not the village, but in the whole county, so that she can represent the women and she can do something for the whole county and not only the village. A visitor once asked her, what do you get out of all this? Why do you do it? And she said, I do it because I have experienced poverty. I have experienced what it is to be an untouchable, to be a widow, to know what it is to lose all the children whom you have borne. My only wish is that when I die, the people in my village will say, once upon a time, there was a woman called Lalan Bai, and she gave all that she had. She shared her knowledge, her love, and because of that, no child in this village dies. No mother during pregnancy or delivery dies. And that is my hope. And this is the challenge that women like Lalan Bai give us who are affluent. We who have the knowledge, we who have substance, very often use it only for ourselves, to better ourselves. But Jesus came. And this is the challenge that the gospel gives us, that we must, with the help of God, release the captive, give light to those who are in darkness, and help the lame to walk, and above all, give the good news to the poor. Thank you.
In the liturgical traditions of the Lutheran Church, there has been a Sunday after Easter called Rogate Sunday. It's a special Sunday that has been a time when the church would pray for seed time and harvest. It was the Farmer's Sunday, the Farmer's Prayer Sunday. Rogate Mashana has a name that matches Rogate Sunday. It's a fitting name for him because he works with the 1 million member Lutheran Church in Tanzania as the development secretary and is helping the farmers improve their life with dairy projects, heifers, oilseed projects, and a whole host of other things. But that's just one part of his work. And the other part is to help to get to that longer term, that freeing of people. Let's put it this way. Lutheran World Relief a few years ago got a letter from some woman in the Midwest, and instead of writing Lutheran World Relief, she wrote Lutheran World Release. I like that. And Rogate is working on that, releasing those who are in poverty. Rogate Mashana.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to share with you our concerns on the poor in Tanzania and Africa in general. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in Tanzania, with 1 million Christians, has already thought of having to go deeper in the field of development, particularly to help the grassroots people who are really poor. And I would like to give you one story, which is very small, but it has a very good significance in the way we do development. One time, I went to a village where we were running a program on water development, and this one was also run by the Lutheran Well Relief through funding. I saw the chairman of the village. He had been in a hospital for 2 weeks, suffering from typhoid. And I asked him why he was suffering from typhoid. He told me that the doctor told him that it was because he had been drinking the water in the village, which we had about 12 diseases. This village had been there for 10 years without water, clean water. They used to go about 6 kilometers away. Women went in the morning to collect very, very dirty water. And the water was almost like coffee, the color of it. And we said, could you just try to boil the water so that you at least will reduce some of the disease inside? They said, if we boil the water, it becomes as thick as porridge. And we see a lot of floating items on top of the water that we can't drink it. So the only way is to drink it without boiling. So they are risking, it's just like somebody jumping from a frying pan to fire. Now they were very happy this time that help was coming. The problem with Tanzania is that villages, although they are organized in a way that they can decide on the way to do their own programs, there are certain things which are lacking in the country, particularly the foreign component, which is supposed to help the farmers or peasants or villagers develop. Now here are villages, a village where they wanted to get clean water, but their ability is only on their labor. They can produce their labor, and they can even contribute cash, but they cannot get the pipes into the village. They cannot buy pipes because they are not available in the country. That's one of the reasons why they cannot even have water, clean water, and the government cannot provide this because that is not available. Our grassroots approach is to ensure that we use all possible available resources in the community, and that the people will participate fully by using their labor. In this particular program on water development, the people said we are going to make a trench of 20 kilometers and we shall contribute 20,000 shillings, provided you bring us pipes. And what we did was to approach the Lutheran Well Relief, and that's where your money comes in. Whether you could provide the foreign component which will help us buy pipes from abroad or from elsewhere. Because the people here are determined, this is their program, this is their need, and they want to do it. When they had a message that the pipes will be available, they started on the trench singing, "Jesus is water of life." And they made a trench of 20 kilometers in only 17 days. And the Lutheran Well Relief was also quick enough. I would say maybe you were quick enough to put you on the foreign component there. And the pipes came. And they were laid, the engineering of the government was ready to give. They were giving engineering skills free to draw the mapping of the pipeline and the fittings of the pipes and so forth to the village. Then when we went back, The first drops of the water were now coming to the village, and they were very, very happy. The only thing which we are going now deeper to look into is we ask questions. For how long are we going to be looking for foreign components like this? Because there are many, many Tanzanians, many, many Africans, like we have seen in the film Niger, who cannot give themselves water, they cannot give themselves food, because they are lacking a kind of power to become self-reliant, and particularly Africa. If you look at Africa and see the root causes of their problem, some of them are man-made. You have seen what is going on in Africa, militarism, coups, and so forth. And they are both because the resources that are available there are so small that people are fighting for things like this. And the result why Africa is being like that is because its economy was directly designed in such a way that it has to serve other countries and not itself. So that we have made agriculture and agricultural policies to serve for outside markets and not to produce food for the people and self-sufficient economy to help ourselves, you know, become self-reliant. And if you see this type of economy, you will find out that because Africa is a basket for serving the North with raw materials, even agriculture is designed that way. And the people are also producing for the markets abroad. It would have been good if the market was equal and the terms of trade were equal, to enable these governments to also bring into the country the surplus which will make these villagers get the right materials to improve living conditions, to buy pipes for the people, to help them, you know, improve their housing conditions. But this is not the case. We have seen over the years and the 10 years which have passed a deteriorating terms of trade and purchasing power of Africa. 20% of our exports has been failing to buy the same, you know, things from abroad. For instance, Tanzania used to buy one truck or one tractor or some steel from Europe. Let's say we put that in terms of a truck. A 7-ton truck rose from Tanzania shillings 66,500 in 1977 to almost double in 1981. But export prices dropped in 1981 for coffee 40%, for tea 29%, and for tobacco 12%. So to buy a 7-ton truck, we had to produce and sell abroad about 4 times as much cotton, or 3 times as much cashew nuts, 3 times as much coffee, and 10 times as much tobacco as we have done so in 1976-77. So what it means here is we have an automatic transfer of the resources from Africa to Europe, and particularly Germany and other European countries like Britain. Here we are selling sisal. Tanzania is selling sisal to the United States. 36% of sisal is sold here. What we are saying is, despite the internal policies we have, and despite the fact that the church is working very hard for the poorest of the poor, these we are trying to solve the symptoms of the root causes of the problem. There are a number of things which we need to solve, and this is the structural problem we have, whereby it has been always a fact that Africa will remain poorer and poorer and poorer. We shall have a lot of grassroots-based programs like this, but if the major determining factor which makes Africa poorer and poorer, where the economies are oriented to serve the North, and little comes back, Africa will become poorer and poorer and poorer. Some of the drought is man-made in Africa. It's not even nature. We see the desert is moving down every year 7 kilometers a year, moving to the southern part of Africa. How do we control that? People say we should not cut trees for wood, and actually we are cutting a lot of trees. 3.6 million hectares of forests are being cut every year, and they are replaced by only 600,000 hectares. And you cannot say to the people, don't cut trees, because you have to give them alternative energy they are supposed to do. And some of the reasons why they cut trees is because they have to save tobacco, the so-called crops that are processed by cutting trees, tobacco curing. They cut these trees, and these are the World Bank programs. So we think that we have something to do here, both to address ourselves as a church to the poorest of the poor, by helping those who are becoming victims of this unjust society, at the same time to work together with the churches here, uncover this root cause and seek solutions together to address ourselves to this socio-economic injustice too. And that's where we are working, and I would be very happy that we get a number of solutions to help us in this particular challenge. Thank you very much.
Your dramatic picture of the trucks and the cotton reminds me of something that your former president, Julius Nyerere, once said. We have so much sisal here, and out of this we can make rope, and we would really like to have some factories in Tanzania so that if we had factories, we could put people to work. If they had work, they would have jobs producing money, and this would be a way of overcoming poverty and hunger. But we find that if we do the finished product here, we have only two ships that are available to our country for shipping this kind of goods. We have to rely on ships from Europe, North America, and we discover all of a sudden that the tariff or the charge for shipping a finished product is at this level per 100 pounds, whereas if we would send the raw material, it's at this level. So there's a real disincentive for us to have factories. And he said, you know, the cards are stacked against us by the way those who have power and ships will set the prices. And we become all of a sudden price takers rather than price makers. It reminds us also of that phrase, God's in his heaven. But we have to add, not all's right with the world. Amos said somewhere, let justice roll down like water. But we are responsible for the irrigation system. And someone who has helped us to understand a lot about this irrigation system of justice is Joel Guajardo, who was born in Chile and is now living in exile in Lincoln, Nebraska, and is working particularly with theological seminaries. Do you think that's funny? Yeah. He is working with theological seminaries throughout the country to help dialogue with them about some of these disparities between the rich and the poor. I'm real pleased to present to you Joel Guajardo.
The Food World Council, an organization related to the United Nations, studied the internal conditions of the different countries of the world and come out with lists of countries that are really in need of food, kind of the most needed countries in the world. Lately, they do have a list of 47 countries that are in this category. Only one Latin American country made that infamous list. The country is Haiti, by far the poorest country in Latin America. With some kind of push, maybe we can extend this classification to two other countries in the Latin American situation. It's Honduras in Central America and Bolivia in the Andean region of South America. So if we read this type of statistic, we maybe will believe that, well, the other countries are doing fairly well then. So we have less of a problem in Latin America than the one in India or Asia and Africa. But the situation is not so clear. And I can assure you that we haven't solved our problems in the other countries of Latin America at all. We do have a very unequal distribution of goods and services in other countries. And since the United Nations and the World Bank and other international organizations will pay attention only to gross national product or per capita income, that is, economic indicators, they are not telling us the whole truth. I've been finding out more and more that statistics can be used in order to lie with class or with kind of, you know, scientifically. You cannot deny those statistics, but they are not in order to clarify the issue, but to muddy it. And this is what happens when you contemplate mostly economic indicators without going deeper and trying to see what is actually happening with the internal distribution of goods and services in a given country. For instance, we were told by the ECLA, that is the Economic Commission for Latin America, that in the 50s and the 60s was a tremendous growth in the economic situation of Latin America, an economic boom. Some countries like El Salvador in Central America were able to maintain a sustained growth of about 10% a year. That, from the economic point of view, is kind of almost a miracle. The same did happen in the late 60s and early 70s in Brazil. The new economic miracle in Brazil was kind of publicized all over. Brazil was really becoming now the awakened giant, if in the past was the sleeping one. But if we look carefully what did happen in El Salvador and also in Brazil, this increase in the economic well-being of the country was accumulated in less and less hands. The elite in those countries grew richer and richer, while the substantial majority of the population of those countries was growing poorer and poorer. In such a way that, well, you know what is happening in El Salvador today, where poor peasants and workers that had been exploited for many, many years, kind of standing up and claiming their rights. In Brazil, the internal condition of the country was so bad, so imbalanced, that the poor also were claiming their right and organizing themselves in order to not only request, but in a very strong way demand some radical transformation in the unequal distribution of the wealth of the country. 20 years of dictatorship in Brazil from 64 to 84 came to an end, and the military power, in spite of still controlling a substantial amount of power in Brazil, was forced to call for elections, and as you most probably are aware of, Brazil is returning, so to speak, to a more democratic path where some social programs are going to be reactivated, where salaries for the lower paid people are going to be increased, where unemployment is trying to be absorbed or at least diminished. So we do have the tragedy in the Latin American context that in the midst of plenty, because the Latin American continent, as the African continent and the Indian subcontinent and Asian, you know, we do have the resources. We are not poor places. We are not poor region. Latin America is rich, and it has been rich. An economic historian, Eduardo Galeano, has written a book that is called Open Veins of Latin America. And he stated that it's paradoxical that it has been the richness of the Latin American continent that has made of it such a poor continent. The richness was so obvious that kind of triggered the greed of the Spaniards and the Portuguese to take silver, gold, sugarcane, coffee, cotton, and other, you know, basic products to Europe in order to finance, you know, their splendor, their nobility, their wars, their luxuries, and leaving behind misery. In this sense, what Rogate said about the situation in Tanzania and in Africa is exactly the same situation in Latin America. We have been unable really to determine our own destiny, to write our own history. We have been dependent on a foreign power that has been making the decision for us, increasing the lopsidedness of the world, where the few have too much and too many have too little. How do you change the correlation of forces in this situation? How do you put the responsibility on the people that are going to live through the different circumstances and situations of history? This is a very real issue. People that don't control, you know, their own lives. And I've been finding more and more certain similarities between Latin America, economic situation, and what is happening here in this country. I've been talking about the Latin Americanization of North American economy, particularly with the farmers in western Nebraska, west Iowa, north Kansas, where I've been relating to farmer associations. I've been hearing time and time again that their predicament, their problems, their crisis today is due to the fact that they don't control what they are doing. They don't control the prices of the commodities that they produce. They don't have any ability to open up new markets. These are political decisions. If the United States government decided to boycott the Soviet Union for something that nasty that the Soviet Union did, the farmers are the ones who are going to suffer. If there are political problems that impede the selling of corn and wheat and other agricultural products to other countries of the world, the farmers get stuck. They produce too much. So they are caught. If they don't have a good crop, they are poor. If they have an excellent crop, there is too much available, the prices drop, and when they spend about $3 to produce a bushel of corn, they are going to get $2.50 for it. Big business, only losing 50 cents in a bushel. Who wants to work that way? So there are problems. The same people that in the past were looking around and saying, well, we are poor. Maybe the poor people around the world are poor because they are lazy. Now, if you touch that point with them, they get furious. And you say, well, you are losing your farm. Most probably you have been really lazy. And they start saying, lazy me? Why, I start, you know, 4:30 in the morning, and they go on and on and on. When they are in noontime, I'm already dead tired, only to listen what they have been doing. Yeah? And this is the situation. Now, what we're going to say to those farmers that according to the studies that are coming out from Washington, you know, 33% of those farmers are going to lose their farms in the next 2 or 3 years. Several hundred thousand families are going to be without means of living. There's something about the dignity, the self-understanding of what farmers are that is also being lost in this process. So there are linkages now between what has been our endemic problem in Latin America and some of the problems that are coming more and more alive in your own society. The big landlords in Latin America, the multinational corporations, who are the ones who are buying the land nowadays? Banks, and the banks relate to multinational corporations. Soon we're going to have quite a different ball game right here in America, a ball game that we have been trying to change in the Latin American situation. So there is extreme poverty in Latin America. Still, according to the United Nations statistics, 40 million peasants in Latin America live with 25 cents of a dollar a day. Now, if you're going to receive that amount of money, are you going to work really hard? What right do we have to label them as lazy or disinterested? Who will really work with a lot of enthusiasm, you know, when at the end of the day we'll receive that, if you receive it? So poverty, undoubtedly, is the cause of hunger. And hunger is clearly related to a very unjust situation that we do have in Latin America, a situation that is not new. It started from the beginning when we were discovered by the Spaniard. Now, what really means to be discovered? I've been saying this in other occasions. You know, I mean, it's just pointed to the ignorance of the European, that they didn't know that we were here. You know? I can write something about discovering, you know, your seminary here, but that's not your problem, it's my problem. But no, we existed only when we were discovered by the Europeans. So the moment of joy for Christopher Columbus and others was the moment of the beginning of serious suffering and trouble in the Latin American continent. Situation that hasn't improved at all, and we need to be concerned about that. seeing this situation of injustice and lopsidedness, people in the 50s and 60s were concerned with development for Latin America. The United Nations was concerned, the United States government through the Alliance for Progress was concerned. Kennedy was clear that in Latin America what we need are the structural changes, land reform, tax reform, educational reform, Medicare, housing for the poor, beautiful things. After 2 decades of development effort toward Latin America, again, according to the Economic Commission for Latin America of the United Nations, the situation in Latin America is worse today than 30 years ago. The rich are richer, the poor are poorer. What can we do? How are we going to bridge the gap between the have and the have not? It seems to me that what we have to do is to take a second look at the real causes of underdevelopment or poverty. As long as we believe that the only problem that exists is the lack of money, we're going to rely too much in borrowing money in order to solve our problems. And this is what Latin America has been doing. The foreign debt of Latin American countries today is $350 billion, an amount that we are not going to be able to pay, that's clear. We are playing with different alternatives, but in the long run, we are not going to be able to pay that. There is not that much money in Latin America. Unless that we start auctioning some country, you know, there is this country for auction. Who wants to take it? You know, it's one possibility. We can do that. But if we are not going to reach that point, we need to just negotiate and postpone a moratorium for 10 years, 12 years, different numbers have been named, but still we're going to be struggling, you know, in order to repay this debt. And all this money, the $350 billion, where they are, what they have been doing, giving more prosperity to the already prosper, helping people to live better, the one who already have a very good standard of living. The poor have been practically untouched. So, what is the real problem in a certain sense? The problem is power. Who has the power to make the decisions that will transform the structures of injustice that prevail in Latin America? As long as the rich and the wealthy on the top are making the decisions, they are going to decide in their favor. They are very insensitive. Here and there they will make a little concession so things will remain the same. Then the solution will come only when the majority that happen to be the poor and the oppressed will have something to say about their predicament. But in order to do that, many troubles, many problems are going to occur. We are afraid of the poor. That maybe is the real challenge of the poor. We like the poor one to one because we still maintain our sense of superiority. Then I am condescending and helping through charity to the poor. But when the poor get organized, when they put their act together and then march on, demanding something, we tremble. We don't know how to take the poor when they are organized. So it's a real challenge for us, the rich in Latin America, and the poor are challenging the rich countries in the world as a general scheme today. But we, it seems to me, as Christians, need to be conscious that if we believe in this God that is empowering the poor, maybe some new good news will come out of that organization. We shouldn't be afraid of letting the poor organize themselves. We need even to assist them as they have been doing in India, in Tanzania, as we, through Lutheran World Relief and other organizations, are trying to do in Latin America, to create some kind of model, some signals that will allow people to stand up and say, here we are. We really want, you know, a piece in the action to do something. We need to be concerned about this, and it seems to me that the Christian community in Latin America, Catholic and Protestant, are becoming more and more aware that if we are going to do something together, we need to listen to the clamor of the poor and to be able to walk with them, to accompany them, to be in solidarity with them, in the same way that our God was in solidarity with us, in Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. Thank you.
Now we are so close to the break time that I want to tell you a story of that's come to my mind as I have listened to these presentations from Gettysburg to Columbus to Chicago to Dubuque to St. Paul and now here, and tonight we leave for California and then on to Columbia, So we'll be making 8 seminaries in 2 weeks, sort of like going through an art museum on a motorcycle. But I'm feeling like I have heard these speeches before, and it reminds me of the man who had gone to many hotels in different cities to give the same speech, and he was riding in a chauffeur-driven limousine, and his driver says, "You know, sir, I think I've heard these speeches so often, I could give that speech myself." And the man in the back seat was very tired, and he said, "I think that's a good idea. I'll tell you what, pull over, give me your hat and your gloves, I will drive, and you sit in the back seat, we'll come up to the hotel, you get out and give the speech." So it was agreed. And the driver stood up in front of this audience and gave a very technically related speech that he knew by memory. When it was all over, there was some time for questions. And somebody in the audience asked a question that was just as technical, but he hadn't thought this one through. And trembling in his boots, he looked at the door in the back, and there he saw his driver. And he said, "You know, I have never, ever heard such a simplistic, idiotic question as all of that in all my life. Why, just to prove it to you, I'm going to ask my driver to come up here and answer that question." So why don't we do this? Why don't we take a coffee break for 10 minutes, and then I will ask these 3 drivers and Larry to come up, and I'll ask them to answer all of your questions, and instead of having small group discussions, let's let this next time period be a time when we can all dialogue together, because I know that some of you will want to ask some questions of Larry. We didn't have that chance this morning, and we don't have the chance now. Can we do that? All right. In 10 minutes, we'll resume.